This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined again by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we've got three sponsors for the show, the first being Jam Software, who provide IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies such as Macs, iPad, iPhone and Apple TV in education organisations. More about them at jamsoftware.com. The show is also brought to you by Shobi, an iPad app for paperless classrooms. Shobi makes it easy to assign, collect and review student work and to provide rich feedback with annotations, voice notes and more. And finally, this episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com. Enter the offer code PUPIL at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Bradley, how are you doing?
Fantastic. Got a
good to be back.
Yeah, it's good to be back. Had a few weeks. I think you're out of town. So we had a... and we'll have a few weeks together and have another week off. So got to love our fun summer schedules. But we're quickly approaching teachers coming back to campus. So summer is flying by here because you've really not been out long, but we get out much earlier than you do.
Yeah, we're just about, I think yesterday was halfway through the holidays. So a little bit to go. But my thoughts are starting to turn back to going back to school. So I've been doing some work this week to try and get ready for some of our new courses that we're going to do this year.
Yeah, I've been busy with I rebuilt our iPad deployment, and I'll talk about that in a future show. Just some of my things I learned when you're redoing something that you've not done in a while, and the modern with different tools. And so yeah, rebuilt our iPad deployment, re-imaging all of our Macs, and yeah, just been a busy summer. A lot of database work as usual. But before we kind of get started on tonight, got some follow up from previous weeks. This is from Lawrence, and he was asking about the iPad Mini. And he says, he remembers saying that Fraser, that he thought the iPad Mini might be a good poor choice for your young kids with fine motor skills, as their fine motor skills are not as developed as older kids. But it sounds like he's reassessed that stand. How do you both view the small tablet now with some experience using the Mini? I'll let you go first.
Yeah, I think with that question, I made that judgment back when the iPad Mini was new. And I think I said in a recent show that one of the things that has just been really obvious to me in the meantime is that if any of our kids have got a personal iPad, it's an iPad Mini. Almost none of them have got a personal iPad that is a modern full-scale iPad. And they all just seem to get on fine with it. You know, they play very detailed games, they play Minecraft, they do all kinds of stuff with that. So I think my concerns may have been a little overstated, possibly. But for us, the thing is that we have, I want to make sure that we have one device for the whole school because of the varying numbers in different parts of the school every year. So for us, it still wouldn't make sense for us to mix the deployment. But I think if you were going to go iPad Mini, I don't think that would be the worst thing in the world. I still do have some concerns for older kids. You know, if you were to go all iPad Mini, you know, having older kids spend, you know, several periods a day typing on such a small screen, I think that may be slightly difficult for some of them, particularly the very oldest kids in the school and a secondary school situation. But other than that, I think as long as the iPad Mini is performance-wise comparable, and that was the other issue that we had in 2013 when we were refreshing the last time, was that the iPad Mini was half the speed of the full-size iPad at that point. And that was a major concern for us at the time as well. But that gap is definitely lesser now, although it's with the iPad Air 2, it's come back to being a gap again when it was closed with the iPad Air. So that's still something to be concerned about and be aware of as well. But yeah, iPad Mini's a strong product.
Yeah, I mean, I think it a lot depends on what your goals for your deployment are, what you're going to be doing with them. And so I would rather someone get a 32 gig Mini 2 than a 16 gig Air, for example. I mean, you know, if you're looking at, you know, when you're comparing budget, I would say for a lot of people, the Mini is a budgetary thing. And I would agree with you that if you're going to be typing on the glass, you know, long form writing, I would really venture towards the Air at that point, because if you're doing like a Mini plus a keyboard case, by the time you do that, you almost could have gotten the Air, depending on what kind of keyboard case you get.
Yeah.
But again, I think you're right that the performance is going to be the big question. And certainly for upper school, with the new features of iOS 9 being only for the iPad Air 2, that's a concern. You know, because you and I had even talked, I think a month or two ago, I was working on a blog for on which is the best iPad for schools to buy. And you know, the iPad Air was like, when you look at the cost savings, it was it was hard to ignore that. You get that, you know, kind of suggest the iPad Air 2 if you're buying, you know, 1,000 of them. But now with...
You're talking about what, a 25% saving, I think it is, something like that?
Yeah, so if you're buying in bulk, it's like really, you know, they're kind of the same device. You know, the iPad Air 2 is a little faster, but they're kind of the same device from a software perspective. But once we saw the new features of iOS 9, it's like it's no longer just a, you know, how quickly is it going to render this video out of explain everything? It's, okay, you can actually do different things with the OS now. And so that's a very much a consideration.
Yeah, I think iOS 9 completely changes the equation for which iPad you should get for school. And it will be interesting to see what happens. We always do this show after the iPad announcement of a year. What's the best thing to do this year? And that will be a very interesting and potentially tricky show as well to see. You know, I'm certainly, my hope is that the iPad Air 2 becomes the new iPad Air, if you like, and becomes the second one in the line, so that you can then have, you know, for less than the absolute top dollar, you can have all the features of iOS 9. And it would seem to make a lot of sense for Apple to do that, to get those features available to as many new buyers as possible.
Well, you know, there is the rumor that the iPad mini is going to go away after this next revision. And I don't know how much stock I put in that because, again, I think it sells pretty well. I guess the only way I could see them doing that is if they kind of merged the iPod Touch and the iPad mini, and it was like a
A bigger iPod Touch?
Yeah, it was like an iPhone 6 Plus style iPod Touch. Mm-hmm. I could see that just from you'd really separate out the iPod line there. And so maybe you don't even call it's not even called the iPad Micro. It's the iPod Touch Plus or something like that. And then, you know, I think you know, you're right. You see when anybody buys their own, like student wise, it's always the mini. And the margins on that.
It's a gateway drug to iOS.
Yeah, and the margins on that are for Apple, have got to be drastically less than the full size. So, I think it all depends. Again, I think it comes down to what you're wanting to do, your budget. But again, knowing what I know about iOS 9, it's hard to recommend a mini over an iPad Air 2, I guess, at this point. So thanks for the question, Lawrence. Second thing is, last show I mentioned like that it would be cool if – last show you and I were on, it would be cool like if the mapping service would help you map out, you know, like where you could eat at. And so Ryan says he kind of been thinking the same thing. He said on their open road maps, from not much help, they show you, you where you are somewhere on the road rather than realize you are between towns and zoom out so you have some context. Common questions that were annoying, answer to where are we, how long to the next town, and what are your options for lunch? And so, you know, I should start like a company around this or something. He said current maps seems to be geared towards going to destination with no deviations other than rerouting it for traffic. For a long journey, they become annoying. I wish they had the smarts to look into the future and realize things like you're going to be on the road at mealtime or at least have a button that's labeled I'm hungry. Maybe somebody will build that. You know, you and I were talking last night over iMessage. Like, now, Apple Maps, like, you know, I think it's fine. I think we'd all argue that Google is like their data's probably a little better just because it's older. But, like, I realized I was like, well, we were getting some hibachi last night for dinner and I pulled up the place. I was looking up the phone number and then I realized, like, in Google Maps for iOS, they had their menu. I'm like, they literally had their, I don't know where they got it. I don't know how Google gets this information, but they literally had their menu in the Google Maps app. And that's making the Google Maps app be more like a lifestyle app than just like a give me directions.
Yeah.
And like I pulled it up. And again, Apple Maps is fine. And you know, certainly if you're an Apple Watch user, it's really fine. And I pulled it at the same place up in Apple Maps and there's no menu. And I think this is one of those places where like, even though Apple Maps has gotten so much better and it's such a great app, I probably prefer the app in some ways a little better, but when Google is adding things like menus to restaurants, that's like kind of taking it a step further than just mapping data.
Well, I completely agree. I use that all the time. You know, when we're away in a family holiday or whatever, I'm in an unfamiliar area and I've found a leaflet or something, or I've seen a poster about a thing that I might want to take the kids to. I want to hit the maps and I want to find out things like, well, how far away is it? Can we get there? When is it open and how much does it cost and what does it look like? And if you go into a location card in Google Maps, it gives you all of that stuff right there. Whereas Apple Maps is kind of like, well, here's the Yelp reviews, you know, it's not always as useful. My experience with Apple Maps is mainly that as long as you get your destination address absolutely correct, Apple Maps is fine. But the thing about Google Maps is you can type in, you know, random name of a farm somewhere in the north of England and it will take you right to the door. And that's the difference is, you know, two words that you might have heard of get you there with Google Maps, whereas you've got to go and look up the address on their website first and then type that all into Apple Maps. So, yeah, that's the kind of thing that Google is still strong on, I think.
Before we move on, let's thank our first sponsor of the night. It's the fine folks at Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com. Use the offer code PEOPLE at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace all is a fantastic place to start a website. You guys have probably used Squarespace before, have state-of-the-art technology powering your website. You have nothing to install. You have nothing to update. It's trusted by millions of people with some of the most respected brands in the world. All the templates are responsive. They are very professional. There's no coding required. It starts at just $8 a month, and you get a free domain name if you sign up for a year. So that's a pretty good deal. When I have literally 10 websites in Squarespace, I think, I always just pay for the year and be done with it. Of course, the downside of having 10 in there is I'm paying for about one a month. So my wife always asks me every month, like, what Squarespace website do we pay for this month? And not an exaggeration. I have 10. So start your free trial today. It's no credit card required. And if you need longer than the 14 days, just ask and they'll usually extend it as well. Go to squarespace.com. And again, when you decide to sign up for it, make sure you use the offer code PEOPLE to get 10% off your first purchase. And that helps them know you came from our show. Squarespace, build it beautiful.
Good, good, good. So I am speaking to you, Bradley, through and on my brand new 13-inch MacBook Pro, which I just received yesterday. And I am so impressed with it. It's really, really cool. I had a 2012 MacBook Air, same one you've got, 8 gigs of RAM, 512 gig SSD. And this one is a 2015 13-inch MacBook Pro with 16 gigs of RAM and a 512 SSD. So I just got it yesterday, and I'm really pleased with it so far. The main thing I wanted to mention to you, Bradley, was the Force Touch trackpad is amazing. And I think it's more than just, you know, technologically interesting, although it is. But something clicked in my mind when I was using it that was not really obvious from anything you hear people describe to you about a Force Touch trackpad. Everybody goes on about how it's amazing, that it feels like a real click, and yeah, that's true. But what I realized was that this takes away the need to do almost or several of the kind of traditional trackpad gestures that you're used to on the Mac with the typical hinged trackpad on the top. And it's really weird because what you can do is you can press down at any point on the entire surface of the trackpad and it feels the same, which you've never been able to do before because the top edge is always much firmer pressed than the bottom edge. But what I thought about this was, well, firstly, when I set it up, it didn't do the three-finger drag gesture you can do on the Magic Trackpad where you can grab a window title bar with three fingers and move it around. That's not a feature anymore. That's been taken away. And the reason it's been taken away, or at least put into the accessibility settings, which is where useful settings go to die, is the reason it's been taken away because on the Magic Touch Trackpad, you never need to use two fingers to do anything, right? Because if you think about it, if you mouse over something and then you click with your thumb to hold the button down while you use your first finger to move the window about, you don't need to do that on the Force Touch trackpad because wherever you put your finger, top edge or bottom edge, you can just press down with your finger and drag that right away. You don't have to use your thumb ever again. And no, I hadn't read that or nobody had mentioned that in any of the reviews to do with the Force Touch trackpad. But to me, it seems like the Force Touch trackpad is a step towards making a Mac feel like a more direct but still indirect touchscreen device. If you think about it, you can use the cursor, put the cursor anywhere, and just touch it and pull it, same as you would do on iOS. I thought that was really interesting and real kind of aha moment for me using the Force Touch trackpad. Really cool.
Yeah, it's I think it just shows that there's still room for innovation in hardware in the laptop/desktop space. It's not just about mobile devices. Thought about that, but still don't want to repair one with the repair guide on it. Still don't want to, I think I'm done repairing trackpads.
It seems pretty complex.
It is, and you're trying to do something that a machine's put together. And let's put it this way, the repair guides mention using sticky notes. So, it's like, I'm done. Yeah, we're out. It's like, shut her down. Deal breaker.
Your computer's dead. Get a new one.
Yeah. Here's a mouse. Sorry. Here's a Bluetooth mouse. I will get a new, I will probably end up with that computer in the spring. So maybe there'll be a new model.
I sold the old one to somebody who had never used the Mac before, but was a very long time iOS user. And it was really interesting to sat down with her to set it up. And she's using a completely different Mac OS than I'm using. You know, I mean, the way that she's going to use that is so completely different from how I have ever used or will ever use the Mac that it was really interesting to me to kind of get a grip of how somebody comes genuinely to the Mac for the first time from iOS and how much of all the stuff that Apple's done that we as longtime Mac users think is sort of stupid and babyish and silly, like things like the launching app and a lot of the stuff that looks more like iOS. But for her, that was like, that just made it so obvious how you would use the Mac is, you know, you click on the launch bar and it would look like iOS and you just click the app you want and it launches, you know, and she was really very, very comfortable almost straight away with it because she just kept saying, well, that's just like on my iPad. It's just like on my phone. And I was really, I thought, you know, I would never use the Mac like that, but she was absolutely going to use the Mac that way. That was going to be her main interface, was, you know, the launcher and so on, and Spotlight search and things like that. Whereas for me, it's all about the Finder and folders and the dock and stuff like that. But she was much more focused on the newer features that Apple have added in recent years to make that more comfortable for iOS users.
Yeah, I didn't think about that. It's like, you know, and there's a lot of people that are still new to the Mac. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe they're an iPad, iPhone, and they've had an old PC, now they bought their first Mac. So maybe a MacBook.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So what else has been going on? We've got the Apple public betas, obviously. Which ones are you running?
I've got them all. I put them on and immediately regretted it because a few things didn't work. Biggest thing, it was like screens didn't work for the VNC app, and they've since updated it to where it does work. Plex doesn't work, which stinks, but that's not a big deal. I can make do. And VMware was like very troublesome. Like I could make it work, but like it was one of those things where I end up having – no, let me just like side note. The number of things on my computer that are broken until I restart sometimes is mind-blowing. Like, why am I – like sometimes mail won't receive mail until I restart my computer. Why in the heck do I have to restart my computer to get an application to work? Sometimes Slack can be that way, and VMware was that way. Like, it just – I don't know. So, like, thankfully, VMware has, like, they call it their technology preview edition, and that now supports 10.11. And then it's nice because it comes with a serial number that's good until Christmas. So – okay. At Christmas time, I'll have to buy like a $49 upgrade. But yeah, I'm like, I'm kind of rocking everything now where things, you know, fairly nice. I really like the new font. I mean, to me, it feels almost like 8.5 is in beta on iOS. So it almost feels like to me 8.6. Like it's just, it's a lot of minor things. I like having the share sheet when I highlight text in mail. That's very handy. Yep. And yeah, I'm just kind of looking forward to seeing what apps can do as usual. But yeah, it's like I really, really, really good stuff so far.
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of small unlearning and relearning required. Things, just the fact that you can do things now that you've never been able to do in iOS before, like attach a file from Google Drive right into a mail that you're composing from mail, things like that. You know, it's going to take a little bit of time to kind of get your head around the fact that, oh, I can do that now. I don't have to do the workaround that I've been doing for 8 years now. So I'm running the same. I've got public beta 2 on my iPad and my phone, and I've got El Capitan beta 2 on this new MacBook as well. And so we're recording with it. I'm using Logic tonight. We've got Skype going. I've got all my kind of crazy audio routing stuff, most of which worked except for a thing that we use called Soundflower, which routes the Skype track into one, or Skype channel into one track and my microphone into another track. The problem with that I ran into was that El Capitan requires device drivers to be signed. And this thing is not signed because it's kind of freeware from the web. So I had to disable that security feature in order to get it to run. So there's going to have to be a bit of a reckoning there to see how we get that to work again. But somebody will take charge of it and sign it on behalf of everybody or something like that. I'm not sure, but I'm sure we'll get there with it. Otherwise, working well.
One feature I'm absolutely loving is the ability to upload files to websites using, like, I have a podcast I have to update for our church on Sundays. It gets sent to me in Google Drive, and we use Libsyn. And Libsyn had a, like, upload from Dropbox feature. And so what I did, I had like a Mac Mini that was running Hazel that would just copy the file from Google Drive into Dropbox. But now, like with iOS 9, I can just like go in there and just pick from Google Drive. And the document picker allows me to swap like Google logins. It's kind of it's kind of hooky right now. Like you can't really click on the top one as easily. Like you can barely tap on it, but it still works. I don't know whose fault that is. But I can literally just upload that file from Drive right to Libsyn. Works well. Still no way to download stuff. That's kind of a bummer, but maybe iOS 10. But uploading is huge.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a really big deal. I mean, you and I have complained many times on the show about the fact that uploading files through Mobile Safari has not been possible. And you know, some people have worked around that with their own apps, but the majority probably have not. But being able to hit a file upload button and pick from iCloud Drive, from Google Drive, from basically any document provider API that you've got installed through an app like the Google Drive app or the Dropbox app or the OneDrive app, is huge. And I think it's going to be really useful. It's going to unlock a lot of things that previously that was a kind of showstopper. There's like, oh, I've got to get my Mac out again to do that kind of thing. Classic one for me is downloading files from one bank account and uploading them to an accounting software app. I do that sort of once a quarter, and that was always something that you just had to use the Mac for because it wouldn't work on the iPad. But that's another thing knocked off, and I think it's going to be a big one.
Before we move on, let's thank our second sponsor of the night. It is the fine folks at Jamp Software. Jamp Software provides IT staff with enterprise tools to power widespread use of Apple technologies such as Macs, iPads, iPhones, and even Apple TVs in schools. They have a great app called Castor Focus that teachers put on their iPad to manage their deployments. It allows teachers to quickly gain students' attention, conduct secure exams within an app, select a specific Apple TV assigned to the class, choose and distribute iBooks, and even initiate AirPlay right from within Castor Focus. Another great thing about Castor is their support is fantastic. I don't know if you've used them recently, but like I was rebuilding my iPad deployment. I was having some issues getting the configuration profile to work. Of course, I had let my one issue I had is I let my push certificate expire, so I had to fix that. But they helped me. I ended up doing URL-based enrollment. Worked fantastic. I got all of our iPads re-enrolled back in the Jamp and really, really happy with it. And their support was fantastic. So if you're interested in MDM software for your Apple deployments, check out Jamp Software and go to jampsoftware.com, jamfsoftware.com. Thanks to Jamp for sponsoring the show this week. So we're going to do like a two-part series here. Is we're calling it the workflow show. It's kind of inspired by our friends over at Mac Power Users on the Relay FM podcast network. They do these like workflow shows where they bring on people and just talk about like the tools they use to do their job. So I kind of realized you and I had never really done that on our show. I think you've been on Mac Power Users before.
I have been on there once, yeah.
So thought we'd do that just to talk about the tool, like, you know, kind of what we do day to day, the specific tools we use to do our job. And these are going to be some apps you guys are familiar with, but we're going to talk about what, you know, how we use them, how we manage our day, how we measure tasks, how people contact us and need help, things like that. So this week is going to be me, and then Fraser will be next week. So if you don't care how I work, you can stop now. Otherwise, keep listening. So I guess I'll start off like, what do I do according to my job description? So my title is Director of IT. I basically handle anything technology related in the school. You know, anything from, you know, setting up projectors for teachers that need help, deployments, troubleshooting, fixing things, helping parents with our, RenWeb, helping parents with our, getting logged into our tuition system, helping parents find things on our website. Just really, especially since I'm a one man department, it kind of like a jack of all trades, because even if it's like not specifically my job, when it comes with like, you know, something on the computer or finding some sort of, finding a resource, I'm probably the person there that's most skilled in doing it. And so I just end up, it's just one of those things you just kind of do it. And I know probably a lot of the people listen to the show where like, even if they're a teacher, they're probably like the de facto tech person in their grade or in their building or in their school. And so you guys know what I'm talking about. Like you're the go-to guy. And there's a part of me that can be annoying because everybody always needs something from you. But you're also like, the go-to person. And so that's job security. And I think it really just comes down to people trust you and they think you'll be able to get it done when they can't. And so ultimately, I think that's a huge compliment. Wouldn't you say?
Well, absolutely. Yeah. And it's, I don't know if you get this, but I always get this whole thing about, the computer knows that you're here, you know, this kind of magical thinking that people are obsessed with. I always ask them, well, how come my computer's broken? It's with me all the time and it's not scared of me. So, you know, go for that. But yeah, it's the way I describe it to people is if it plugs in, it's my problem. And that's pretty much true across the whole school.
Well, and that's in recent years, that's extended a lot more deeper into our operations for me with, HVAC, CCTV, complicated payroll software, time clock software that's digital. I mean, it's really now so much of our operations are just flat out digital. Our entire purchase ordering system is digital. You request a purchase order to be approved. It's approved and emailed back to you as a PDF with a number. And I'm ultimately responsible for all that. And we're always fighting with our HVAC software because anytime Java has a big update, it breaks it. And then they're looking at me to fix it. And I just tell them to call the HVAC company. Like, I mean, there's nothing wrong on our end. Because then the HVAC company always asks me, well, you need to update Java. I always then remind them that Target was hacked through their HVAC system. and so that's why we update plugins. Yeah. So the apps I depend on daily. First one is Mail. And we're a Google App school, but I still use Mail.app mainly because I use iCloud personally. Just it kind of works. It's not the best app. There are aspects of the Gmail web app I would prefer, but I've just got too many email addresses. Mail.app works well. Really starting to use Slack a whole lot. That's not necessarily. There's a couple of people at work I'm in a Slack group with, and some of the other teams I'm on for some freelance stuff, I have Slack groups with. So that's become an invaluable resource for me. I'm also in a Mac administrator Slack group that I just joined, and that's actually, I think, going to be really, really helpful because it's really just people that deal with Apple products all day long. So I'm really excited about that. Next on the list, apps I depend on, Evernote. Those should be no surprise. So like really what I use Evernote for work for. Good example is like our phone system. I have a phone system notebook. Anytime like there's a little quirk that I can't figure out and I have to call our phone vendor or I email them, they email me back how to fix it, goes into Evernote. So something like happens occasionally, like our phone system has day mode and night mode. And occasionally like the receptionist will tap the wrong thing to put it into night mode during the day. And no, it's all automated. And so I don't know how to get it back into day mode. So now I know because it's in Evernote. Website notebooks, information like, how to manage our website. And it's used not stuff like how to update it, but like how to do the alert badge. Like if there's we have like a little thing we can have a little top yellow bar that goes across the top like, hey, school's canceled tomorrow due to closing. That's like a weird little plugin I have to enable and certain coding I have to do. So that's just in Evernote. Just easy me. They emailed it to me, send it to email, Evernote via email. And I use the heck out of Cindy Evernote in my email. That's to me one of the features that keeps me using Evernote over any other tool because it's so easy to do that. And then I have a bunch of notebooks on our student information system. Again, same thing. There's a bunch of reports I run like once a year. And so when I was getting taught how to do them through the support chat, just, copy and pasted those right into Evernote. And they're always there if I ever needed to go do that. Things like report cards, birthday lists, just little tips like that. So it's just kind of a catch-all place for me for stuff I know I'm going to need again, but I don't do it enough to remember it.
Other things in there like product manuals and things as well?
No, I don't do that for work stuff because a lot of those are like, personally I do that for like, we just bought a new stroller and stuff for a new baby. So, I found the PDF of that manual and threw it in there, but a lot of that stuff is like living, breathing. So like the manuals from Aerohive, well, that changes as their software changes. So those are more like wikis and things like that. And then I throw things like, I have like travel notes in there. I have a notebook called HR and Communications that just has things like our tax exempt form, our insurance information, our payroll, like how to log into the payroll system, official school calendar, things like that, templates for report card or no, I'm sorry, templates for diplomas. Our fifth grade ones are done like professionally, but like we print the, like the kindergarten graduation things in house on cardstock. And so I have all those templates in there. But yeah, Evernote's like it's just a catch-all place for me. A new addition to the list, and please don't disconnect the call, is Wunderlist. So I've been using
OmniFocus. Bradley, we can't be friends anymore.
I know, we're done. It's like bleeding many contexts. So I think like I've used OmniFocus all but about 6 months since 2009 when it was in like beta. And I tried Wunderlist like 2 years ago, and my biggest complaint with it was the syncing was very troublesome. And apparently then it's like gotten a whole lot better. They have a new platform that it's built on top of. Microsoft owns them now. And so why I switched? A, I was bored like two Fridays ago. And yeah, that's what I do when I'm bored. Change.
It's a classic productivity opportunity to gain customers is a boring Friday.
And it was like 100 degrees outside, so there's nothing to do. And like I like Wunderlist, like I really do. And I think it OmniFocus for what I do is a lot. It might be overkill because I'm not managing extremely large projects. My big thing is knowing what's due today and what's due this week. And so like Wunderlist shows me I can, and of course OmniFocus had this too. I just want to see like, okay, what is due today and what's due this week? And I, as I, you know, tack off stuff that's due today, I can start looking ahead of the week and getting ahead. And so like my day is spent working on my task list of things that I know I have to do. And it's also responding to support requests. And obviously support requests come first. So if I'm working on a report and someone needs help, like I just stop that and go help them. But Wunderlist, it kind of clicks in my mind. And they do have some pretty cool collaboration tools, but I don't have anybody that uses it. My wife, she doesn't want to use it. I wish we could use it for grocery lists. But I did turn on family sharing, so now we can use a shared reminders list. Mm-hmm. So yeah, using Wunderlist right now for tasks. I'll probably be there for the foreseeable future. I paid for re-upped my year on premium, even though I didn't really need it. I like to pay for the tools I use, even though they're owned by Microsoft. Another thing I use a lot is Sketch. And so like when someone emails me, has a question like, hey, how do I do this in our email? Or how do I do this in RenWeb? Like instead of just trying to like hand out like how to do it, really, you know, type it out, I'll just sketch it and add some text on there and send it back to them. Works very well. Another app I use for things like that that are more in-depth is an app called Clarify. And I'll put links to all these apps in the show notes. But like Clarify is kind of like Sketch meets product training manuals. And so it allows you to take screenshots of things and build like descriptions and add arrows. But then you can have like text box under it to add actual instructions. And so I have these built for a lot of things that we send to parents, like how to pay your tuition, how to pay for lunch charges, how to check your grades. So Clarify makes it really, really easy to do this. You can export it as a PDF and lots of cool things. Solver, I don't know. You know what I'm talking about? Like Soulver. Is that Solver, I guess?
Yeah, I would go with that.
Just budget management, you know, keep a running total of like how I'm on my budget for the month. And then I kind of reconcile that at the end of the month with our accounting person. Of course, iTunes, actually loving Beats 1. So I basically leave Beats 1 all day. Obviously not too loud because there sometimes can be songs in there. They're not totally appropriate for kids. yeah, I'm loving Apple Music so far. Next app is iMessage. You know, for better or worse, iMessage has become like the de facto way to turn in tickets for me. And, you know, it's great. It's great for users. And I guess ultimately, like, I should be okay with that. It's great for users because it's very, very easy to get in contact with me. But the problem is there's no way for me to, like, track that in terms of, like, there's not, like, a history of I can't go into, like, trash or archives if I miss something. I would prefer them come in through via email, but they don't always. And people have a habit of like contacting me when they think about something, whether that regardless of what time of the day that'll be. And the only problem I have with that is sending someone an iMessage is basically asking them to read that when they see it. Where an email is a little bit different, in my opinion. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, a message is a direct ping to your wrist. There, you know, it's not something that you can really queue up and not bother with until another time. So yeah, I mean, the thing with messaging based support requests is that it's fine for you and me who are one person teams, but that no way does that work when you have even two people. You have to move to something more kind of formalized, even just for two people, to make sure that somebody's handling it. Can you get people to email into Wunderlist? Is that a thing?
You can, but right now it is like it's like you send it to me at wunderlist.com. And it has to come from like your registered email account. And that was actually one of my big complaints with it previously. And it still is because I have multiple email addresses. So I just have it set, you know, obviously from my work when we get through 95% of the things I'll email in do. But they told me like just this week that they are going to be allowing multiple emails real soon. So I imagine you'll have like a unique email address like OmniFocus does. So it would be fantastic just have people email me at Wunderlist. They're probably not going to do that. And again, like you said, if there's a team, you basically have to, if you're a team, you basically have to tell people, even if they stop you in the hallway, just log a ticket, you know, and people, that's kind of has to be your de facto response because Just say that's where we track it. That's where we can know we've gotten everything done. But you know, go back to iMessage. My big complaint with that is putting people in work mode when they may not necessarily be at work and forcing them to become in work mode. So like if it's Saturday and you have like a thing you're thinking about, hey, I'm going to need a projector Tuesday, and you text it to me, that's putting it then on me to remember that, and that's making me on Saturday think about work when I'm with my family. And and I don't think that's fair. And so I like make a concerted effort to just not text message people outside of work hours if it's about work. I can email them, and that's their choice to check their email or not. And I have – so like my kind of my new rule is I don't respond to any text message after like 5 or 6 o'clock. I will certainly read it, but I don't respond because I realize is no one expects me to work 24/7. But if I'm always answering, I'm making myself available 24/7.
Yeah, you've got to take a little bit of charge of that, don't you?
Right. Yeah, it's my – I can't control people texting me, but I can control responding. And if they think I respond, they'll text me. So I just don't respond, and I respond –
don't encourage them.
Yeah, I always respond at 6 a.m. No, I'm kidding. No, I usually like will start responding. If those come in after hours, I'll just start responding after 7 in the morning and say, okay, I'll look at this today. I'll look at this today. And then just throw those into my task management system, which right now is Wunderlist. So those are some of the apps I use. Obviously, like managing our network, I kind of live in a Hive Manager for our Wi-Fi, which I don't go in there a ton. Network's really solid. I update firmware about once a quarter, regardless of what Arrow Hive has out. I just do it when there's like a break in the school. I have our switches that I can log into through a web interface. Again, I don't do that very much. They kind of just work. We don't have a real complicated setup. Our firewall, which I'll occasionally have to do, log into our SonicWall to make content filtering adjustments. Of course, I've got a duplicate. I think I mentioned on the past show the new DHCP server. And what I'm doing is I'm actually running the SonicWall and the Windows DHCP server in tandem, but they're just on a different scope. And our vendor kind of recommended this to me just as a failsafe. He said, because, we had an issue where our power went out a few weeks ago, and it was actually almost out for 24 hours. And obviously the SonicWall would come up much faster when the power came back on than the Windows server would. So the SonicWall could start handing out DHCP requests, even though it's a little slower on the resolution resolving that. But they're handing out different scopes. And so 99% of the time, the Windows server is the one that hands out the DHCP request. But if it's busy or if it's slow, the SonicWall can take over. And if one of them goes down, I have a backup, really, literally right there running at the same time. So I use log me in to a couple machines I need to get to on campus from offsite. Use that. And I use Screens VNC quite a bit. That's really, to me, a great app to have on your iPad when you're out and around campus. If you need to log in someone's Mac real quick, you can do that. And Screens makes that incredibly easy.
And really, really good on the phone as well. Particularly the iPhone 6 Plus.
Yes. So before we move on to the rest of the stuff we use, let's thank our last sponsor of the night. It's the fine folks at Shobee. You guys know Shobee. It's an iPad app for paperless classrooms. With Shobee, teachers can quickly and easily assign, collect, and review student work on their iPads, and then provide rich feedback to students by adding annotations, text notes, and voice notes directly on the documents. Students can show their learning creatively by submitting to Shobee from thousands of compatible iPad apps, or by completing assignments with Shobee's built-in tools. Shobee keeps everyone organized with individual student assignment folders, email, and push notifications. Shobee Basic is 100% free, and teachers can, if you want to start with your students this coming fall, you can, totally free. Just download Shobee on the App Store or go to Shobee.com. Now, if you love Shobee Pro and you're a school administrator and you want to upgrade, you can do that, and they'll give you a special deal. If you go to Shobee.com/out of school and you buy Shobee Pro for 5 of your teachers, they will give you an additional 5 teachers for free for a year. So that's a pretty good deal. Shobee.com/out of school. Thanks to Shobee for sponsoring the show this week. So next few things, chapel. If you're not a religious school, you probably don't have chapel, but we have chapel. And so I'll talk about some of the software we use for that. There's an iMac in the sanctuary, and this is a lot of this is like the church's equipment that we use. So we use Dropbox to kind of share files. And well, the cool thing about what I'll do here is plenty of times people will send me like PowerPoints or keynotes that they're going to use in their chapel talk, because we have a different teacher that kind of heads chapel up every week. And sometimes they speak, sometimes they bring in someone like a pastor from their church or, just something. So I often get like PDFs or PowerPoint sent to me. And so what I do from my phone, I will save them into Dropbox, and I've got a folder called Chapel, you know, Chapel Transfer or something, and that's in my Dropbox. And then we have like just like a generic Dropbox account on that computer, so I can just save it from my phone in the Dropbox, and I know it'll be there when I log in, and that works well. We use a program called ProPresenter most of the time for our presentations. And that's if you're not into, like, if you don't never been in, like, in church media, that's a big church media software. And it's really, really actually handy. You can drag in, like, it can download songs from, like, the song libraries. And then you can drop in, like, you know, backgrounds with motion backgrounds, and it has the Bible built in. It's really quite handy. And we use that a lot. And we can throw, like, keynote files in there, and we'll throw worship videos in there that the kids will sing along to. Obviously, Keynote, we use that as well. We can't use PowerPoint at all, because like there's a three screen setup, and one of the screens is like hooked in via USB and a custom driver, and that uses that ProPresenter software. It's called a stage display, so like the guy leading worship can see the time, the songs, and just different things. And mm-hmm. PowerPoint does not like that, and I cannot get it working where like the right thing is on the right screen. Keynote's fine with it, so if someone sends me a PowerPoint, it gets opened in Keynote.
For better or for worse.
For better or for worse. So the best one, I think, you know, you and I were talking about this a few weeks ago. We're talking about, like, you know, presentation horror stories. And like the best was when someone brought me a children's book and said, I wanted to put this on the screen. So I had to scan it into like JPEGs and then turn it into Keynote like the day of. That was real fun. Then also important for chapel is YouTube ripping skills. Plenty of times people like have YouTube videos they want to show. And so just knowing how to rip those off YouTube and download them is like sysadmin skill number one at schools.
What's your preferred technique at the moment?
KeepVid, I think, is what I use. It like, seems to work well. And I have an app like Mac X YouTube Ripper. I don't know. KeepVid.com. What do you use?
I use File2 HD, number 2 HD. When I'm on my Mac, they've got a website they can use for free. And on the iPad, I had an app called Titan Video, which basically just hijacked the play command in the HTML version of YouTube and would download the URL. And that was quite effective. The problem with all of these things on iOS is that they are all rated 17 plus. So whenever the kids want to, you know, have a video in, say we're doing this project where the kids had to have a video inside a PowerPoint presentation that they were building, and a lot of them wanted a YouTube video because it illustrated a particular thing they were doing or whatever, and they were all just airdropping me links to YouTube videos, and I just spent a whole hour just downloading videos and airdropping them back to the kids or putting them in Google Drive after hours or whatever. So that kind of thing is, you're right, it's something everybody wants to be able to do, but is deliberately so is kind of hard to do. And there are ways and means, but like you said before, it's job security forever if you're the guy that knows how to do that.
Oh yeah, because it's always changing, like a Java update will break something. Next thing is our website. So our website is on WordPress. I would have preferred Squarespace, but we kind of did. I think I even talked about this on the show. I really pushed for Squarespace, but we ended up hiring like an outside company that was going to do it fairly cheap to design it. And they said, we either do Joomla, I think, or WordPress. And I was like, well, I know at least no WordPress, so we'll do WordPress. And so I would have preferred Squarespace, but you know, it is what it is. But I do handle some of the content. Our headmaster actually does a lot of it, but then I handle all the updates. So like WordPress, they just did a big update today, 4.2.3, and the auto update failed, of course. And so I had to I go in there and update it, keep the plugins up to date. And, you know, I'm the de facto guy when you have things break. So, again, it's on WordPress, and they host it for us, the company that built it. So if something went awry, I would expect them to fix it. So one of the last things I do every week is we have this thing called Notes Home. And we send out Notes Home and Overviews every Tuesday. And so overviews are like for each grade of what they're doing this week. So the parents can be aware of like what's due, when our tests are. Those go on our website, and then we have Notes Home, which are really meant to stop sending 30 emails to all parents every week. Like this is one email to rule them all. What we're running into is like people won't want to put some of this stuff in there for 6 weeks. And what happens is it ends up being so long that no one reads it.
Yeah.
And so what I started experimenting with last year was like, okay, we're going to have like a monthly Nuts Home, and then we're going to have a weekly one. And so like the weekly one is just stuff that happens this week. So then I said, I want everything in there is like a tweet sized snippet. So like something on their phone, they can just quickly scan through. We'd have a link to the monthly Nuts Home, and we have a link to the overviews right there in the email. So it's like real, but people, it didn't work because people still wanted, they kept putting like, you know, I need this in there. This is next week. So I have to have, it happens on Monday. So I have to end it this week. And then they wanted paragraphs, and it really just ended up being more work for me. So I think this year we're going back just to the monthly Nuts Home. So, or the weekly Nuts Home, where it's going to have everything. And I really just want to cut it down because, you know, we talk about parents not reading stuff, but like as a parent of our school, I don't read everything because it can be long. Yeah. And it's tough to try to like navigate, you know, there's no way to like send out a one specific to grade level because some stuff is really only specific to like third through fifth or, you know, the kindergarten K3, K4, K5. So I don't know. These are like just communication problems, but people are busy and it's hard to get them to take time to read it.
Yeah. We use MailChimp for that. And we have segmented lists so that we can actually target individual or multiple groups within. So I can't exactly remember how it works, but you can put custom attributes on an individual email address, and so we have one for every class. So you can pick whatever email addresses match whatever attributes and send it off that way. We'll talk more about that in the next show if I can dig out the details on it, but it's been quite effective for us this year overall.
Well, and we can do that through RenWeb. Like we can customize. I can say, I just want to these homerooms. I just want these grades. And I can do that. But like, it's just the trouble is figuring out what's relevant to
who's people. Relevant for. Yeah.
And so it's almost like you need like school news curation services. You know, need nuzzle. Yeah. You know, of course, at the end of the day, like most people find out about stuff from Facebook. Like that's where most of our parents see information about the school is Facebook. And it's probably genius on Facebook's part. When we have something really important, I'll pay $5 to boost the post so I know everybody will see it. Because it shows you like, you know, 150 people saw this. Like, but we have like 1,300 followers. Why did they not all see this? So I just like pay it so more people will see it. I guess that's their like strategy. But
that's the business.
Yeah. And I guess it's just like, I don't know, like, email is just like not the way to reach people. It's almost like I need like a school Slack channel or something. I don't know.
Really interesting you say that though, because I mentioned this just at the end of term. We did a survey of our parents and asked them how they wanted to be contacted, and the results in that, we got something like 60-70% response rate, which is awesome. It was overwhelmingly in favor of email in almost every category of communication we asked about. You know, we asked about things like parents' evenings coming up, report cards, adverse weather events, planned trips, things like that. And in almost every category, it was like 70% email was what people wanted, and the rest was SMS messages to their phone. And, you know, we were getting like 2% where they wanted Facebook to be the thing that they wanted. So what I did there was I sort of forced people into one choice rather than multiple choices. But when forced to make a choice, they all said they wanted email first and then SMS second, and then the rest afterwards.
Yeah.
So I guess it's different places, you know, it's different cultures.
Well, and SMS is tough just because you're so limited on what you can say. And really, the challenge with social media now is it's with Facebook especially, you can't guarantee that you'll see everything from that school even if you like them. And at least with email, you know that you can go in there and, you know, if they've sent that to you, it should be in there.
Unless you're sending to people with Hotmail, apparently, which is a constant problem we've had this year, is Hotmail is spam filtering all over messages, which is annoying.
Yeah, that is frustrating.
Through all the channels, and there's nothing I can do about it.
Yeah, and it's like the parents are like, "Well, you know, what can you do?" It's like, sorry, you know, we had an issue like years and years ago on our old Exchange server where Bell South emails like we're just not accepting emails from our Exchange server. And that, again, that's one of the reasons I'm glad I'm not in the mail server business anymore. So that's kind of like, you know, that's kind of how I do my job. I try, I'm in the heart of the school operations, like offices in like, you know, front of the school near where parents come in, across from the headmaster, like I'm very involved. Try to make myself always available to people. We're having teachers coming in now, you know, just having questions and trying to get started for the year. Yeah, those are kind of like some of the tools I use. I work primarily from my Mac day to day, just mainly because I'm at my desk. This will be my first year teaching full time, not full time, but teaching the whole year. I'll have five classes that I'll teach each every 6 days. We have they were 30-minute blocks last year, and I actually asked them to be. We're going to do 45 minutes. 30 minutes is just not a long class, and 30 minutes, 45 minutes.
No, it's not.
It's time you just get. It's time you get going. It's like you kind of lose. 30 minutes turns into like 25 minutes by the time you get started, and 45 would give me 40 good minutes of just, you know, actual instruction time. So that'll be fun. Looking forward to that. And I think that'll really make me better at my job, as certainly as we kind of think through our next deployment, which is in the spring. So we're making our last payment to Apple in about 2 weeks. It'll be fun. Mm-hmm. Pay off that lease.
Excellent.
So yeah, that's us in a nutshell.
That's the story. Yep.
So my advice to people is be friendly. You know, at the end of the day, we were talking about this today about like customer service and just how you treat people. And talk, you know, one of our school secretary, her son is working at an Old Navy this summer. And I was like, you know, I worked at retail in college, and I really think those are like valuable work skills for people, because you really learn how to treat people in every job. You ultimately have somebody's your customer. And even if I didn't deal with parents here, the teachers are my customers. And like, it's your job to, if you serve them, like, it's your job to treat them well and to help them out best you can and really go above and beyond. And so I try to really look at it as like, everybody here is my customer, whether it's a parent, whether it's another teacher, and really just treat them. This may sound dumb, but like, I want to treat them as I would want someone to treat my wife in the workplace. She worked at the bank, we got married, and like they kind of gave her like a hard time about changing her name when she got married, and that really like kind of offended her. And so like I go above and beyond, like when someone, of course Google makes it easy now, they used to not, but they make it easy, like go above and beyond and make sure all their stuff says their new married name, because they're proud of that, and I want to make that easy for them. And so just treat everybody as like they were, as I would want someone to treat my wife in the workplace.
That's a golden rule.
So, one of the things that's new this year for us is we have a new male faculty teacher. We have like me, the headmaster, and the PE teacher is male, but we have a new fifth grade teacher this year, and he is male. So that'll be fun. And we actually had a lot of parents like request that, mainly because when they go to middle school, it's a lot of male teachers. And so trying to get them adjusted to having some more male teachers is good. So like our fifth graders, they will actually have three male teachers between me, teaching technology, our PE teacher, and then like our third through fifth, they really kind of rotate classes. Like one teacher will teach history, for example. They kind of kind of like more than how they do it in middle school, and help get them prepared for middle school. So they will have kind of half female, half male in fifth grade. So that'll be good.
Yeah, it's interesting working in an industry where the gender balance is the other way sometimes. People always talk about in tech, you know, it's all male dominated, but in teaching, it's in certain areas of teaching, it can be very much the other way.
Okay, so I guess we'll wrap it up there for this week. So next week will be Fraser's workflows. Mm-hmm. So if you found mine boring, I'm like really interested. Like I love these kind of shows, like just hearing the tools people use, and even if it's like the tools I use too, but maybe finding some new ways to use them. So. Mm-hmm. So we'll be back next week. Thanks to our sponsors, Jamf, Shelby, and Squarespace. You can find links to everything we talked about in the show notes at outofschool.net. If you haven't recently, it'd be great if you could leave us a review on iTunes. And if you work with people that you think would like the show, or you share it on social media, share it via email with your colleagues, we would certainly appreciate that. Kind of helps keeps the lights on here. And there's nothing better to, I know it may be like self-serving, but I love hearing from people and they say like, hey, you know, your show really helps me out, and I evaluate it because, I mean, we put in a lot of work to it, and it's like awesome to hear that it actually helps people, because that's one of the main reasons we do it. But I'm on the web at chambersdaily.com, and I'm on Twitter at Bradley Chambers.
Mm-hmm. And I am on the web at spears.org and Fraser Spears on Twitter.